Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Section 8 Housing, the Housing Choice Voucher Program, awards subsidies to people with very low incomes to help them rent any qualified apartment or house. The trouble is, the program is broken, especially in the South. The idea behind this 50-year-old program was to give low-income individuals an opportunity to leave public housing and send their children to higher-performing schools, and to prevent seniors and veterans from becoming homeless while preserving more of their money for food and other basics of life. Like so many other things in America, demand for the vouchers and the housing they provide access to is high, while the supply is low, and most of the supply is in low-income neighborhoods. Award-winning investigative reporter Fred Clayson Kelly turned his sights on this growing problem for a series of reports in USA Today that began yesterday. He joins us to share some of his findings. Welcome back to the program, and congratulations on being at USA Today, I guess.
Good to see you. Yeah, thanks for having me on your wonderful platform. Appreciate it.
Thank you. He's here along with Katie Zeger, a research associate at UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute. The organization worked with Fred Clayson Kelly on a six-month project to analyze local and national data on this topic. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks.
And Fulton Meacham is also with us. He's president and CEO of Enlivion, formerly the Charlotte Housing Authority, and they run the Section 8 program here in Charlotte. Thank you for coming back. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for the opportunity.
So, Fred, let me start with you. You titled this series Segregated by Section 8. We're going to talk about what that means in a second, but why did you turn your attention to Section 8 in the first place?
It really started several years ago. Here in Mecklenburg County, they do the point-in-time homeless count. And when county officials and volunteers go out and search for people sleeping on the streets, and they do sort of a census. And every year when I worked at the Charlotte Observer, we would send a reporter. And one of the things we kept noticing is that some of the people who were sleeping behind dumpsters or in the woods had vouchers. And it just sort of stuck with me. And I just thought whenever I got the opportunity, I would go out and try to do a story, not necessarily on the program, but on the faces of the people who were suffering.
Fulton, I've talked about Section 8 housing vouchers. He just mentioned it again. Tell me what exactly they are. Who qualifies to get them?
Yes, the Housing Choice Voucher is a program that basically subsidizes a person's income. So rent could be, let's say, $1,000 for a one-bedroom apartment. What we do is the resident pays 30%. And Livian pays the other 70%, making that unit affordable for them. We have a lot of families, I think, in Mecklenburg County that make minimum wage. And so it's difficult for them to find units that they can afford without this Housing Choice Voucher. So that's what the Housing Choice Voucher is. It's basically a rental subsidy at the end of the day.
And there are two sides to that equation. So people have to qualify to get the vouchers, and then you have to find landlords willing to accept the vouchers. Who handles that side of the equation?
We handle the side of the equation of making sure that the rental subsidy is available. We also go out and recruit landlords and housing providers to participate in the program. But what we normally find in a lot of situations, there are multiple issues going on. One, there's not a great supply of affordable housing in general, so the market is extremely tight. And then when some families that have a voucher that absolutely can afford the rent, we have this issue called source of income discrimination, where housing providers will just not rent to a Housing Choice Voucher participant.
We'll talk about why in a little while about that. Fred, you call this series segregated by Section 8 because of what you found in the course of your investigation, that over 70% of the voucher-subsidized housing is located in minority-concentrated neighborhoods, despite the fact that 80% of the areas you looked at had median rents lower than the small area fair market rent, which means vouchers should be more evenly distributed than they actually are. In other words, there is housing available outside these minority concentrations of minority and poverty available. What's the explanation? Why is it the way it is?
It's both a simple explanation and a complex explanation. The simple one is this. America has a long history of racism that continues to this day. And the image of race and the image of poverty is one that is negative in a lot of folks' mind. And they do not want to deal with the folks who need that kind of help or the type of folks they think need that kind of help. And so what we found when we went out and talked to people who tried to use a voucher is that even when they had long work histories, and in some cases, even when they had good credit histories, and even when they were military veterans, when they went to landlords and said, hey, I want to rent from you, the landlord would initially be very interested. But then once they said, hey, I'm going to need to use a voucher, the landlord said, hey, we don't deal with that, or we don't know what that is, so we don't trust it. So you're just simply rejected. One of the reasons we called it segregated by Section 8 is that the program is sort of premised on a promise that folks who need help can move to places where there is high opportunity, good jobs, good schools for their kids. It's sort of premised on a promise that it's mostly Black and Brown recipients can move to areas where historically they've been denied access. And the promise by the federal government simply has not been kept. And Mr. Mitchum is being nice. His office does administer the program, but in a lot of cases, these local housing agencies have not been given the money and other resources needed to make the program fully effective. You know, when people do get help, when they do get a voucher and they do find housing, it does make a difference. They have greater housing stability, they avoid homelessness. The problem is not enough people get help that they qualify for.
Is that why your regional editor at USA Today called this program an extreme failure?
Yeah, I think so. I think when you fail to serve 3 out of 4 people who qualify for the program, it's hard to call it anything else. I think that one of the things that happens is, as reporters, we look at these things through sort of a political lens, sort of a Republican, Democrat, right, left thing. And really, it's really a matter of this. Do people have a right? Do people have a need for housing? And can their lives be whole without being stably housed? Can kids grow up healthy? And the question after that is, what do we do about it? And are we willing to do anything about it? And I think by saying that, he's saying our answer for many decades has been no. And that in many ways, we left it to Fulton Meacham and all these local agencies to carry the weight, a historical weight, that the whole country should really bear.
And speaking of that, I know you're concentrating on 4 states, primarily in the South. And the Southern Region editor of USA Today is the one who expanded this series and allowed it to go on for 5 different editions of the newspaper, yesterday, tomorrow, next Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. But is this problem particular to the South, or is it simply more severe in the South than it is in other parts of the country?
Well, one of the reasons that we wanted to do it in the South is the South has a very unique and tragic history with race. It has a history with Jim Crow. And this program is specifically designed to try to address some of those historical wrongs. And so we wanted to hone in on the South for that reason. We also wanted to hone in it because the South is home to the largest percentage of African Americans, more than in the Northeast, more than in the West. And the program, both its successes and failures, have the greatest impact on that community.
The series is
peppered with... Michael?
Go ahead, Fulton.
Just to reiterate what Fred is saying is that I think we know Charlotte is 50 out of 50 when it comes to economic mobility, right? That means when you're born poor in Charlotte, you pretty much stay poor and your children stay poor. And one of the indicators of that is segregation. And what we see in a microcosm of the Housing Choice Voucher Program, something we can actually measure is where our families are able to live within Mecklenburg County. And I think we've said earlier, most of them are staying in very high impoverished areas and don't have a way to move around. The voucher is one of the best programs in the country to allow a family that may have a job that wants to move to Charlotte, North Carolina, to move to Charlotte, North Carolina. Public housing didn't allow that because the subsidy stayed with the actual apartment. But they are able to take this subsidy and move where they want to move, supposedly. But when they get to a market like Charlotte is extremely tight, as well as has this thing called source of income discrimination, it puts people in a bind where they can't move where they would want to live in a higher opportunity area where they have good schools, low crime, close to transportation. They're pretty much redlined and only living into these other communities, which perpetuates the issue of segregation that we see here in Mecklenburg County.
Let me bring UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute person into this conversation, Katie Zager, because although a lot of these articles are based on shoe leather reporting and interviews and with various stakeholders in the Section 8 program, it's also based on a lot of research, much of which was compiled or done by the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute. You analyzed the federal government's data on this. You examined what's going on in 19 different cities, I believe. Is this the first time this kind of an analysis has been done with this data?
It's definitely the first time this type of analysis has been done, both concentrating on southern cities, and then I think what really sets our analysis apart is the types of cities we look at. So traditionally, this type of analysis has been done and, you know, the 50 largest metros are comparing large cities to large cities. And, you know, our list includes places like Gastonia or Anderson, South Carolina, which only has a population, I think, around 50,000. And so I think just being able to say, you know, this isn't confined to just large urban areas, that this people are facing these types of barriers in all kinds of communities. I think this is kind of the first study to take a look at it from that angle.
And I have about a minute left in this segment, Katie, but what kind of data were you looking at? What were the facts and figures that you were looking at to figure out exactly what's going on?
Sure. So HUD has a data set of the census tract or the neighborhood in which these housing voucher eligible units are located. And so we mapped those, and then kind of in line with, you know, the promise HUD has made, which is to get people out of concentrated poverty and into more diverse neighborhoods. So those were really the two main variables we looked at. As we saw, high poverty neighborhoods are defined as those where 30% or more of the population lives below the federal poverty line.
And we'll stop there because we have to take a break. Katie Zager is with the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute. We're coming back with more on Section 8 housing in just a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Fred Clayson Kelly is with us. He is an investigative reporter with USA Today who just took a look at four states in the Southeast and how they deal with and what the situation is with stakeholders who participate in the Section 8 housing program. The series in USA Today is called Segregated by Section 8. He got help on that from Katie Zegar from the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute, where she is a research associate. And Fulton Meacham is also here. He's president and CEO of Enlivion, which is formerly the Charlotte Housing Authority. Fulton, Fred reports that more than 8 million households are eligible for Section 8 housing vouchers, and yet only 2.2 million households receive them. How does that compare to what's happening here in this area, in Charlotte, in Mecklenburg County?
I'll say those numbers are about right. I mean, so I would say about one in four people that actually need a voucher actually can receive one.
Why?
Because the federal government at the end of the day supplies these funds to housing authorities across the country, and there are just not enough vouchers, I think, for the actual need that's out here in the public right now. So it's so critical for us, for those individuals that do have a voucher, for them to be used and be used in the way in which they want to lose. It's called the Housing Choice Voucher for a reason, right? They want to give people and families choice to kind of live where they would like to live, especially in these markets that are extremely tight. You know, our average rents are around here for one bedroom about $1,300. And so it's very difficult for working families to be able to afford that. With the COVID as well, and a lot of people have lost employment, is even more of an issue. And so I would say this in general, there's just much more need than the actual supply of funding from the federal government to support this type of rental subsidy.
This series of reports says that some people in the South, and this may be the truth all across the country, I don't know, but in the South, they wait a decade to get a Section 8 housing voucher, and some never get them. And Fred reports that most people who qualify for these vouchers never get them. And you said it's because demand outstrips supply, but is this something that the federal government knows about? Are they aware of this? Will this series open their eyes to a problem that they didn't know they had, Fulton?
I definitely think it will. The series is definitely opening a lot of eyes. I think the administration now has already put out some emergency vouchers that Enlivion has gotten 178 of those, but the demand is still much higher than that. But there are two sides of the equation that we've talked about here is that, okay, so we have more. Let's say we have 1,000 more vouchers. The question is, do we have 1,000 more apartments for those families to live in? And so it's a supply issue too. This is a relationship between, it's a public-private partnership at the end of the day. And so in order for it to really work, we have to have more supply, more housing providers accepting these vouchers so these families will have a stable place to live. Without that, you still just have vouchers, but they won't be able to be used because there's no place for people to live.
This program was launched, and we'll give them the benefit of the doubt here, with the best of intentions. And some of the things that we're talking about and some of the things that you've uncovered through your research at UNC Charlotte and, Fred, your reporting are just simply unintended consequences. But it was not intended. This program was not intended to segregate people into racially minority areas or into low-income areas. It was designed originally to spread them out away from housing projects, to give them an opportunity to raise their standard of living over time. But in fact, it has left a lot of people homeless, according to your reporting, Fred. Why? Why would you be homeless in the face of vouchers?
But it's another one of the situations where it's both complicated and simple. Some of the simple solutions are some of the simple answer is just the program does not cover a lot of the expenses that it takes to move. The folks who get vouchers don't have $1,000 sitting in the bank to go pay a security deposit. Many folks do not have cars to go look at places. They certainly can't afford, a day's worth of U-Haul rentals. Some folks have bad credit histories, and so they may not be able to get the power turned on in a timely fashion. And the program simply does not cover those costs. And so we see people who are in homeless shelters have a voucher and have trouble being able to find a place to stay. We see people living in extended stay motels, have a voucher and have trouble finding a place to stay at a most basic level. And then you add in the source of income discrimination, which has been mentioned. Landlords across the vast majority of the South have the right to just simply turn you away because they don't like the way you pay the rent.
But it's a guaranteed payment. I mean, the government is writing the check directly to the landlord. Why would the landlord not accept a guaranteed payment?
So the landlords, if they were on here, would make this argument. And I heard it, the same things over and over and over again. One, they don't like going through the extra inspection process that the government has them go through to make sure the place is suitable. Two, they have a belief that the folks who get vouchers are more likely to tear up their place and not be held accountable.
Is that true?
I haven't had anybody show me a study proving it.
I'll say it then. Absolutely not. There's no evidence at all that working families on the Housing Choice Voucher program have a predisposition to tear up units more than anybody else. There's no evidence of that at all. But these are perceptions that Fred is talking about. In some cases, these are prejudices that Fred is talking about that have now woven themselves into policy.
And Fred, there was a third point you wanted to make there.
Oh, and I think that the other point they usually make is they talk about getting delayed payments up front. So when they want to rent to somebody, they get their money later than they would if they just dealt with somebody who wasn't in the program. And according to them, they lose money on the front end. Of course, you know, the housing agency says, one, the delay is not as long as they say, and that they are made whole eventually. Yeah. They largely view this as a, you know, when we talk about having laws, there's like over 100 states, counties, and cities that have laws prohibiting source of income discrimination. And landlords have fought against that fiercely across the country. Landlord and realtor associations here in Charlotte have fought against proposals here.
Although you have not released the one story, I know that one story deals with the fact that there are people in the political process, politicians, who also have real estate interests who are pushing against this. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. I think when we come out with the story, I don't have my numbers in front of me, but at least, and it's probably an undercount, one out of every five members of the North Carolina General Assembly have real estate interest outside of their personal residence. They either work in the industry, they are landlords themselves, or they do legal work for landlords or the real estate industry. Yeah. And that's going to make it pretty hard to pass a bill against source of income discrimination.
Just to underline what you and Fulton have been talking about here with regard to landlords who don't want to take these vouchers, Stephen emails, I worked in the apartment industry for almost 10 years. The additional cost to the landlord is real due to the additional cost involved in paperwork. How onerous, Fulton, is the paperwork for these folks?
I'll say in the past, I think the paperwork was definitely a lot more than what it is now. And Livian is a MTW agency, moving to work agency. So it allows us some flexibilities away from regulations that other housing authorities that are not MTWs have. We have created systems where it's a lot more streamlined now for housing providers. And when they start talking about losing money, we pay a $250 bonus just to sign people up on the program. We pay, for 14 days when the unit is down, when somebody moves out, we pay for you. We pay the rent on that unit even when there's nobody staying there. If you lease to another resident, and we have $1,000 now risk mitigation fund. So if there are any damages in the unit that go beyond the actual security deposit that every landlord gives or receives from a participant, we pay $1,000 toward those damages. So what we've done is try to work with, and this has been over the last 3 to 4 years. I mean, Fred knows this as well. We've been doing this for the last 3 to 4 years. These are our partners. Housing providers are our partners. I would say that we need them for the program to be a successful program, and we've listened to them and their issues, but still we just haven't had the market penetration that we would expect based on the problems in which they've talked about that we've already tried to solve for. So we're still just not getting more of our families the opportunity to live into multifamily apartments throughout Mecklenburg County.
So Katie, what your analysis at UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute shows is, and this is government data, what it shows is that rather than breaking up concentrations of poverty, it's exacerbating that situation. It's putting more and more people into low poverty areas from which they cannot extricate themselves. Clearly, this was not deliberate. Is this just something organic that's hard to fight because of our history of racism and our people not wanting to live next door to somebody who is lower income?
I mean, there's a couple things that our research shows. So one is the majority of housing voucher eligible units and the majority of neighborhoods are both actually fall in between this kind of low poverty and high poverty neighborhoods. But what we found in cities like Charlotte is even the medium poverty neighborhoods, so those that are between 10 and 30% poverty rate, the majority of voucher holders are still in minority concentrated neighborhoods. So even though they might not be, you know, have a super high poverty rate, they're still, you know, significantly minority concentrated. And there's two issues at play here. So one is we didn't really look at the underlying distribution of housing as much as how much we would expect each neighborhood to absorb. And so one of the issues that we're capturing is just the complete lack of, you know, multifamily, single family rentals in a wide variety of these neighborhoods. And so part of what we're seeing, you know, in addition to the failures of the Section 8 program, is also just, you know, the issues that all renters face in trying to get to better neighborhoods. And so Section 8 just really adds another layer, you know, of discrimination and bureaucracy and issues on top of, you know, what our housing issues already are.
Fred, you say that, just to put a number on this, how bad this is, you say that more than 70% of voucher-eligible housing is concentrated in minority neighborhoods with rampant, your word, poverty. And in an article that will run tomorrow in USA Today, you say the Section 8 housing program reinforces Jim Crow patterns across the South, and that flaws in Section 8 leave poor people trapped in, quote, monstrous, depressing places. That is how President Richard Nixon described public housing projects at a time when he put a moratorium on their construction and offered these vouchers instead as a way for people to rent from private landlords. And the end result is that, quote, public housing apartments have been falling into disrepair and vanishing at an alarming rate on purpose. When you combine that with the lack of affordable housing and landlords unwilling to get to take vouchers and people unable to get these vouchers, that creates a, I don't even know if I have a word for how serious that problem is. $70 billion backlog in repairs at these housing projects are needed, plus no place to go. How can this be going unnoticed?
I don't think that it is going unnoticed. This is just true. Whenever you go to any city of any size in America, we all anticipate there's that one side of town you don't want to go to, or is the quote bad side of town. Mm-hmm. We in America have had a high tolerance for financial and economic suffering. And what we see with the lack of investment in public housing, the lack of investment in the voucher program, is you know, sort of a breaking of the social contract. You know, the government was the landlord of last resort for many decades. Public housing was created sort of in earnest in the 30s to help save the housing industry. And at that point, it will mostly serve white folks. And what we saw is more Black people and more brown people moved into those spaces. The federal government failed to keep up the repairs. They failed to make the necessary investments to make the programs viable. And so I think that these problems are known. I think you could go on Google right now and find out about them. I just think that there's been a lack of empathy. And I think that there's been some, let me put it this way. I covered poverty for many years. And if I call Charlotte city officials and I said, hey, what about these folks who are desperately poor and can't move into all these new apartments you're building? The one thing they would tell me is, well, that's Livian's problem. Like, that's who they handle. And I'd be like, but aren't they living in Charlotte? And yeah. And then, of course, I already knew, like, Livian's money was being cut left and right from the federal government, and they were trying to figure it out themselves. And so I just didn't know where that left us as a community. And then I didn't know where that left us as a nation, this is in fact happening all over the place. And so I don't think it's unknown. I think it's just ignored.
And like everything else, it seems these days, a lack of political will to do anything about it. This is a social issue. It's an infrastructure issue. It's a crime issue. It is a poverty issue. It is a societal anger issue. It covers all the bases, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's look, if you don't have housing, you got nothing, because the housing is determining where you go to school, where you work, what your neighbors look like, if you have a park next door, if you have a place to go catch the bus. It is central to everything your life is about.
When we come back, Katie, I want to talk to you about how you compared Charlotte and Gastonia. And if I read your statistics correctly, there's a difference in what's going on between these two towns. And we'll talk about that with Katie Sager with UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute, Fred Clayson Kelly from USA Today, and Fulton Meacham with Livian in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Fred Clayson Kelly's series, which started yesterday in USA Today and goes Tuesday, Thursday, this weekend, next, in a conclusion series, article next Friday in USA Today called Segregated by Section 8. He joins us today along with Katie Zager, research associated with the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute, who did a lot of the legwork on coming up with numbers and maps and things like that that show exactly where these problems lie. And Fulton Meacham is with us. He's president and CEO of Livian. Katie, when you compare, if I read your stuff correctly, and I'm challenged when it comes to numbers and data, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you compare Gastonia and Charlotte and the intersection of affordability, minority concentration, and concentrated poverty. Gastonia appears to do a better job of breaking up these pockets than Charlotte. Is that accurate?
Yeah, so this research was an effort between me and Providence Adu, who's one of our graduate PhD assistants, who's a lot of the legwork on this. When putting together the research, one of the reasons we looked at so many cities is so, you know, Fred's colleagues or other reporters could look and say, well, what's happening in my city? What does the data look like here? And so that's why I thought it'd be interesting to compare Charlotte and Gastonia.
Well, you say that every single census tract in Gastonia is, quote, voucher affordable, with the majority of voucher eligible units in non-minority concentrated medium poverty neighborhoods. Is that just because of the way Gastonia has developed over time, because of its population and the makeup of its population over time, or are there other factors at work?
I think part of it is just that Gastonia is more affordable in general. So yeah, the way the pattern looks there is that the levels of where the voucher units are distributed are kind of what we would expect based on the demographics of the neighborhoods, that you know, the majority of neighborhoods are non-minority concentrated, kind of medium poverty. And yeah, I think it really has to do with just the fact that Gastonia is more affordable, and the difference between the rent in the highest, you know, most expensive neighborhood is a lot smaller of a gap between the rent in the least expensive neighborhood. So yeah, people just have more options. And then part of it is just the underlying demographics, is that, you know, Gastonia is a whiter city.
So the Urban Institute at UNC Charlotte took federal housing data and created maps that reveal where housing for voucher holders is available. And you say these maps reveal that where housing choice vouchers are accepted, those areas line up with minority concentration, and perhaps not coincidentally, with the old redlining maps, which were put into place during Jim Crow to keep black people out of certain neighborhoods. You say that research can't prove discrimination, but is that what you can infer from what you found and these maps that you've drawn?
Yeah, I mean, when you just overlay kind of these old redlining maps with where these housing units are located, it really pops out kind of which neighborhoods. And I mean, we can't prove discrimination, but I mean, we see this legacy of redlining in tons of indicators and outcomes for people. And so, you know, we know housing is connected to health, is connected to wealth. And so, you know, it's just really this legacy, you know, of this policy that was done decades ago, you know, impacting how people perceive neighborhoods, and still perhaps impacting what kind of investment is made in which neighborhoods. And really, more so, what it really reflects is the lack of investment to change these decades-old patterns. Is that there's just been a lack of will to undo what's already been done. And so that's where, you know, we get these, you know, older, more affordable units still concentrated in the same places they've always been.
Fulton, you do this every day. You deal with this every day. So I'm wondering how you see this. Do you see this as evidence of racial or economic discrimination, or is it simply NIMBYism?
I think it can be all three. I mean, so I've seen it all, from some individuals just not wanting to rent to African Americans, to the things we talked about before. Well, there's a little bureaucracy going on with the program. That's why I don't want to be there. Then NIMBYism, you know, we are a city that is pretty much the have and have nots. And I think it keeps creating these issues of when you're not in proximity to someone else, it breeds a little fear because you don't know who they are. And what we try to do at Enlivion is make sure that we have mixed income communities. So the public housing that we once had now are all mixed income communities, where people from all walks of life can kind of live, work, and play. But in the marketplace, it really is basically the only thing you see being built in apartments are pretty much luxury housing. Right. So you have this homogenized group of individuals that are either the same color, same economic structure, versus the rest of the population kind of living separately, but keep creating these issues of NIMBYism or racism or whatever you want to call it, that keep putting our families in situations where policy now mimics this, because the fear creates the policies that go along with it to say, hey, we really don't want those families near us. Can you create policies that create that basically separate us? And that's kind of where we are. And I think we got to keep working extremely hard to push back on that, because we do have examples in Charlotte where we do have mixed income communities where people from, again, very low income families living with very wealthy families. I can think of Dilworth being one of those examples, that it does work. And so we got to keep breaking down those fear factors so that we can help create policies that really help our families move in, up, and out of poverty.
In the first of Fred's series of reports on segregated by Section 8, which ran yesterday in USA Today, his report starts in Anderson, South Carolina, not very far from here, and he writes about a woman sleeping on the street after the trailer that she was living in, paid for by Section 8 vouchers, was deemed by the federal government not to live up to the standards required for those vouchers, and the landlord refused to meet those standards, so they said, you have to move out. And she could not find any other place to go. What are the requirements for landlords? What standards must they meet?
I mean, these are basic housing quality standards. If I had to boil it all down, I mean, the things in the unit need to work. I mean, the lights need to turn on, the water needs to be able to go through, the plumbing, toilets need to work. You can't have, you know, cracks in the floors, holes in the ceilings, holes in the walls. But in the marketplace, when you don't have Section 8, some people are actually living in that kind of environment. We just can't spend public money on those type of apartments. And so,
I understand the moral principle behind that, but this woman, and I'm sure this is anecdotal evidence, but I'm sure her story is similar to thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of other people. They told her she couldn't use her voucher for that unit. She couldn't find another unit. And if she could find another unit without voucher, she could not afford the security deposit and the first month's rent to get into that unit. So is it better to have somebody living in substandard housing paid for by these housing vouchers than living on the street?
Well, I think that's a really tough question. Our public dollars shouldn't be used to pay rent to a landlord that doesn't keep up the unit, right? So there is a lease that's involved in this, and both individuals have a responsibility. The landlord has a responsibility to maintain that apartment, make repairs, and et cetera, and the tenant has a responsibility to pay the rent. If the landlord isn't meeting his obligations under the lease, then the tenant shouldn't have to continue to pay rent, and the federal government shouldn't have to pay rent to a landlord that doesn't do that. And so it wouldn't be proper use of federal funding to be able to do that. And I think, again, having more access to housing is one of the keys.
Fred, you spoke with a woman named Allison Johnson, who is the executive director of the Housing Justice League, which is based in Atlanta. She also brought up the inability of most Section 8 housing voucher recipients to pay for security deposits. And she followed up by saying the program isn't being allowed to function as it was set up. Explain that.
Well, what she's really speaking to is that the program makes a promise to people that their lives can be made better, that they will be better able to meet their basic needs of food, clothes, and other things like medicine. But that the program as it operates can't live up to that promise. It simply, in many cases, does not offer folks enough help. Sheila Simmons, you know, lives on about $500 a month in income. And so for her to come up with a large sum of money to move is just an impossibility. It really is. She can't drive. She barely can walk with a cane. So to expect her to go and look at a bunch of places and say this or that, if she was on this program right now and she tried to utter two sentences, her COPD is so bad that you could probably only understand about a fifth of the words.
Wow. You, Fred also reports, Fulton, that when somebody gets a voucher, they must find apartments or houses that meet inspection standards and where the rents do not exceed the program's limits, and they discover that landlords often refuse to accept those vouchers in payment. Why, then, is there not a central clearinghouse of sorts for tenants who have these vouchers to go to say, okay, I can pick from these locations and go there and they'll take my voucher?
Well, we do have on our website units that are available, but most of the time, by the time that somebody goes and calls them, somebody already has been there and put in an application. So we're again to go back to the supply aspect of what we've been speaking of. But we also have done something in Livion is increased our payment standard. So what we know is the rents in Charlotte are going up 20-30%. And so normal housing authorities still have to stay within the housing HUD's basic payment standard. We've been able to move that up. Okay, and so now we're able to pay in some cases in these higher opportunity areas, whatever the market rate rent is for those families to be able to live there. So that created an opportunity for more of the market that we could actually compete with. The issue still is, will they accept that voucher, right? And so at each and every turn, you have issues, just like you're talking about, well, does the federal government supply enough funding to really support all the needs of this particular participant? I would say no, because it's a straight line rental subsidy program. Then when we are adding additional dollars to meet the market demands when it comes to the rent, we're still having issues with, housing providers and landlords accepting it. So those are the issues.
One of the other obstacles that your data uncovered, Katie, is the phenomenon that we've talked about in other programs about other things going on in the city, and that is that a lot of single-family homes are being bought up by Wall Street investment firms and turned into rental units, which would seem on the face of it to be perfect for this program, because if you want to move people out of high-concentrated poverty areas, you could give them a voucher and they could rent a decent home. But some of these companies are not renting to those folks. And you found that the one company owned by a Wall Street investment firm has put moratoria on accepting these vouchers. Why? They don't live here. They don't care where people live. They're not living next door to these folks. Why do they care as long as they get the money?
Yeah, I mean, kind of based on, reporting I've seen on the fact that, Tricon was terminating the leases of Section 8 voucher holders and then not renewing them. It's basically, it comes down to the fact that they want to maximize profits on these units. And they for whatever reason, don't see voucher holders as the way to do that. So, theoretically, they're renovating the units to increase rents even further. I don't know, what exactly that looks like. One of the things these Wall Street firms tout is that we are opening up opportunities into neighborhoods that families or renters would not otherwise be able to access. Through their policies and their decisions, they're definitely limiting the types of renters
homes perhaps that middle-class Americans could not afford to buy because they can't come up with the down payment, but they can't afford to rent them, but it still limits who can actually live there, not because they want to, just because of the economics of it. Fred, President Biden has pledged to pass legislation to prevent landlords from rejecting applicants for vacant houses and apartments just because vouchers will be used to pay the rent. Has that come before Congress yet?
Not to my knowledge, it has not. They're right now trying to debate the Build Back Better plan that is in somewhat of a disarray right now.
It's in disarray in part because of opposition from Senator Joe Manchin, the Democrat from West Virginia, who has said he fears that some of the things suggested in the Build Back Better program, and although this is not in it, it would fall into that category, appear to be entitlement programs.
Right. So one of the things that is on the chopping block right now potentially is Joe Biden's proposal to expand vouchers. There's been a lot of reporting around the fact that that might not be in the final version of the bill. And so if you can't expand the number of vouchers, the chances of you going against landlords on source of income discrimination are pretty low.
Noel emails, I take exception to the negative way projects living is portrayed. I grew up in the projects in New York City and am eternally grateful that my parents had the opportunity to raise my siblings and I in a positive, healthy, stable, and welcoming environment. Yes, there was crime, but there was crime in Midtown Manhattan. The project I grew up in is still standing and housing the citizens who are our critical employees, police officers, teachers, bus drivers, private and public sector workers, etc. So perhaps that's an unintended consequence of allowing projects to decline because we're not putting enough money into them. The USA Today series from Fred Clayson Kelly, segregated by Section 8, continues this week and next with solutions suggested in next Friday's installment in USA Today. Fred Clayson Kelly, one of our guests, Katie Zager, one of the researchers at UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute who helped contribute to that, and Fulton Meacham, president of Inlivion. Thank you all for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.